Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thank you, one and all, for being here, spending part of your time with us, because otherwise we'd be sitting here doing it by ourselves, which would be really silly. My guest tonight is Jason Gregory, and his new book is Fasting the Mind, Spiritual Exercises for Psychic Detox. And I just found what he has to say totally exciting and interesting, so I'm looking forward to talking to him. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing. And I'm going to do something a little bit different. Somebody that follows me on Facebook and also listens to the show on podcasts asked a question, and it was a longer question that I could really do justice to with a Facebook private message. So I said, well, how about I'll answer it on the show for a metaphysical musing? So it feels a little bit like a call-in advice show. You know, so-and-so wrote from wherever, but Diane from Facebook asks, when you talk about beings that accompany you, like your dragons and angels, do you believe everyone has them, but most are not able, capable of, or willing to see them, or do only a few have these companions? And that's really a great question. That came from the conversation last week with Maureen McElroy. And it's really a two-part question. Are the various unseen beings there for everybody? And what does it take to tune into them, to be aware of them? And those are both really good questions. Those beings are there all the time, especially the angels. The angels are available to human beings all the time and usually very close, but you have to ask. The old adage, ask and it shall be given, is absolute instruction on what needs to happen with the angelic realm and the archangels and all the rest of it. It's all well and good to believe in them and to study them and whatever else, but if you don't actually ask for their presence or ask for their assistance, they can't. They literally are not allowed to intervene in the realm of human beings unless you say, hey, over here. And it's very helpful if you call them by name. The dragons are like a lot of other what people have come to think of as fairy tales, fairy tale creatures. So elves and fairies and all the other stories about conscious entities, and they exist all over the world. So there's fairies in England and leprechauns in Ireland, and there are different names for them, and they're different races. They are different looking and do things differently all over the world. Every culture has them. Every place has the stories. Everyone has some people that interact with them. So the dragon realm in many ways is a similar idea. It's something that people have been in touch with for thousands and thousands of years. And dragons are similar in some ways to elementals, to the consciousness of nature, but also similar in some ways to the angelic realm, especially to the archangels. And I haven't quite gotten a grasp of exactly what all that means. And they are slightly different, but I'll tell you the story of how I got in touch with the dragons. And maybe that'll give you an idea of how this works. My dear friend, Frank Brown, who's been on the show several times, is part of a mystery school studying teachings from all over the world, but the core teachings go back to King Solomon. It's a very old tradition. And one of the things that they were doing was dragon magic. He had a teacher that was teaching dragon magic. And so he was in touch with some dragons, and he had some dragon companions, and we would talk about it. And I started whining, as best friends sometimes do, "You got dragons, and I don't have dragons, and that's not..." And he finally said, "David, you know how this works. You have to talk to them and tell them that you're open to meeting them and having the honor of their presence. And as you do that, eventually they will make contact with you." You know, whining, because that's what we do together. And so I did several rituals where I got quiet and talked to the dragon realm, not having any idea. You know, it wasn't as if I knew who I was talking to or what I was doing. It was just putting out the idea of, "I know you're there, and I would love to have contact with you." I lived in a small apartment on the second floor, and the front door opened to the other side of the building, and so there was an inside hallway. And every night I would open the door and thank the angel that I had asked to protect my door in my apartment. And I'd wake up in the morning, I'd do the same thing. So one morning I opened the door, and the angel's not there. There's a blue dragon. So I said, "Hi, who are you?" "I'm Charlie." "Hi, Charlie. What happened to my angel?" "I relieved her." "Oh, what's that about?" "I do this now." "Okay, well, thank you for being here. We need to get to know each other." "I'm happy to be here." Obviously, Charlie is not a conversationalist, and his energy is very much like a bouncer at a nightclub. He's a very nice guy. He's very quiet. He's kind of, you know, laid back until there's a reason for him to get between you and danger. And so Charlie was my first dragon, and we started getting to know each other. Charlie is still with me. It's been years. He has protected me from all kinds of strange things. And then one day, Charlie is blue. And then one day I realized there was a presence of another smaller dragon. And I was like, "Hi, who are you?" "I'm Sammy." "Hi, Sammy. What are you here for?" "I'm here to keep you company." So I sat down to watch TV, and Sammy sat down next to me. And for the first time in my interactions with dragons, I could feel him lean on me and put his wing around me. Call me crazy, whatever. That was my experience. His job was just to hang out with me and make sure that I didn't feel lonely. And Sammy is still with me. And there are several others that have shown up. I was thinking it would be nice to have a service dog. But the way I've been walking lately, I couldn't walk the dog. So maybe a service dragon. You know, it was kind of a joke. And then Gilda showed up, and Gilda is my service dragon and helps me heal my hip and make sure I don't fall over. Once the conversation is open and you're open to the experience and you allow the experience in, things start to change and all kinds of things go on. Maureen has a bunch of dragons that hang out with her. And it's pretty funny because they're kind of like one big household, her dragons and my dragons. And sometimes they come and visit. And sometimes I get a message that's something like, "Hey, is Tobin at your house? I haven't seen him in a while." Because both of us have that experience. Actually, the first interaction I had with her was at a convention, and she walked over to me and said, "Hi, who's your friend?" "What do you see?" "The dragon, of course. What's his name?" "What color is he?" I'm still checking to see if she knows what she's talking about. "He's red." "What's his name?" "That's Sammy." "Say hi, Sammy." That was my first interaction with Maury. So, I hope that answers Diane's question. I hope it was fun to do it this way. And if any of you have a long, rambling question you would like me to address inner metaphysical musings, send me a Facebook private message and we can do this. It's kind of fun. So that's tonight's metaphysical musing. And let's have some fun, speaking of fun, with Jason Gregory. Thank you so much for being with us all the way from Thailand.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on, David. Thank you.
And as people will probably notice from your accent, you're not from Thailand originally.
No. No, I'm from Australia, born in Australia. And I've actually, lived most of my adult life in Asia, you could say. But, yeah, born and raised in Mackay, small town called Mackay, Australia.
Uh-huh. And that's actually a perfect opening to the question I always ask, which is, how did your life unfold? What was the journey? What was the walkabout that got you to the place you are now, knowing this fascinating stuff that you're sharing in the book, Fasting the Mind? I know there was a long process. You've been all over the world and studied with many different traditions.
Yeah, it's true. I never had one, I guess you could say, aha moment like some people, you know, think that they have. But, you know, my life was a natural sort of progression to where I am now. And I never grew up in a religious family or anything like that, or a spiritual family. You know, my parents were pretty much just, you know, your average middle class people. And, you know, once I always had an interest in obviously travel and cultures, different cultures, because, yeah, nothing against Australia, but Australia is pretty much a, you know, it's just like America. It's a standard sort of,
except for the outback and all those things that can kill you, but yeah.
Yeah, of course. Well, in Australia, they don't promote a lot of the original people's, you know, culture. So the Aboriginals culture in Australia. So, you know, you have really wide indoctrination and education over there. So I never knew, I always had an urge to travel and experience different cultures, and I always had an interest in philosophy. And it wasn't until I met my wife actually in Sydney back in my mid-20s that she's from South Korea, and she had traveled all over the world and so forth and so on. So that was kind of my calling to actually, you know, get out of the rut in Australia and start to really do this and live the life and actually seek out the traditions that, you know, that I always wanted to. So, you know, I started traveling extensively through mainly just Asia. So I've lived in India, Nepal, Thailand, but I've been everywhere around those countries. So I've been to, you know, Laos, Myanmar, Vietnam. I've been into the Middle East and everywhere. So for 10 years, I've been in Asia and studying, you know, mainly first of all, I came across Vedanta in India and studied Vedanta in Tiruvannamalai in the southern part of India, and, you know, all through India actually, and classical yoga on top of that. But in other places, I've studied Buddhism, Theravada and Mahayana, specifically Zen, and Taoism also from China. So because I was a traveler, I just went to the places that really I was attracted to. And then once I went there, I would come across certain students of a certain particular tradition or a master, and just go from there and, you know, integrate that into my own practice. And the interesting thing is, once I broke away from Australia, I just started writing naturally. Like, I didn't really seek to be a writer or a teacher in Eastern thought, but it just kind of naturally happened. It wasn't something I was asking for. So That's kind of it in a nutshell, really.
Well, that's an amazing adventure. You know, you make it sound so offhanded. I just went to India, studied Vedanta and yoga. And I know from the little bit that I've done that's a whole lot more demanding than you make it sound.
Well, it is. It is. It's a lot more demanding, especially if you really integrate the practices and follow the philosophies of all the traditions, you know. So, and I say classical yoga too, because, you know, a lot of the yoga practice around the world is really only hatha yoga, which is a physical aspect. So,
right.
You know, there's a lot of things you can learn from yoga when you study the philosophy and as well, right. And the other aspects of yoga. Yeah, I know. I know. I make it sound a little. it's a lot more interesting what I can explain. But the thing is that all of the experiences that I've had in the last 10 years of studying Vedanta, Zen, Taoism, and a lot of other traditions is, you know, we would need a whole day to talk about. But that's just kind of like a brief overview. So,
right. No, I'm not letting you gloss over how intense the experience must have been and how much it took in each location to put yourself in the situation, be accepted, you know, and get the trust of the group and the guru, and then learn the practices, many of which are really demanding.
So, yeah, they are. I'd like to add too, David, that even though I learned a lot from the ancient Eastern traditions and that, I probably learned most from just being engrossed in the cultures of different places. You know, living in India is completely different than America or Australia. It's an upside down world, but you can learn so much from being in different cultures. You know, Terence McKenna actually once said that you know, if you drop yourself somewhere like Ghana or something, somewhere completely different, it's like rewriting your subconscious a little bit. So
right. I got to do that for a couple of months in Haiti during Baby Doc's dictatorship, and my perspective on many things, but especially what's going on in my country at the moment, are colored by the fact that I lived in a military dictatorship. Mm. So I have a very visceral sense of what that's like, what it's like for the people that aren't going to leave at some point. You know, you wind up integrating an understanding of things that's totally different from reading about it or other things. So I have great respect for, you know, the kind of walkabout that you did and that you spent time in all those different places. And different traditions. Did you find that going from tradition to tradition set up conflicts in you as you heard the new perspective and the new teaching, or did you see the underlying themes as being very similar?
I kind of went back and forth with that a little bit. Like, there were certain things that obviously conflict between certain traditions, but
sure.
I do feel there is an undercurrent that is very similar with a lot of traditions, but it can get lost in conceptual frameworks and particular understandings of, you know, not only students but even teachers, you know. So, right. I don't know. I don't gravitate towards one over the other. I love them all, you know, and I have obviously a strong affection for Asia in general because I live here. But there was definitely that. There was. Obviously, there's different, like, even if you look at two of the oldest Indian traditions, if you look at Hinduism and Buddhism, there's similarities, but there's also conflicting interests, you know what I mean? You know, but you can weed through that a little bit. If we look at if there's two concepts, right? We look at Atman and Vedanta, which is the self, the undifferentiated consciousness, which is beneath the idea of the person of David or Jason, which is connected to Brahman, which is the ultimate reality, that which gives us life. And then you look counter to that, you look over in Buddhism and you have the idea of the non-self. So that idea that there is no real self, no David, no Jason. But when you study that a bit further and you go further into it, they're almost the same. They're almost the same concept, just clouded with words. And what I found, especially with students of Advaita Vedanta, so non-dualism, is that they just can't get their head around that. You know, they come sort of from the perspective that Vedanta is the original teaching, so it's the best teaching.
Right.
And I think that's a bold statement, but deep down, when you look at that. The two traditions that have argued about that for thousands of years are almost talking about the same thing. You know, right. One's talking about the self. They're talking about undifferentiated consciousness, which is beneath the personality, And in Buddhism, then, are talking about the non-self, which is that the person doesn't really exist. You know, it's a temporary phenomenon. And it's like, well, isn't that the same thing? You know,
so. Not if you're choosing to be on opposite sides of an argument, but yes, it's very much the same thing, at least exactly. As far as I've ever been able to tell.
As a
total aside, which I don't want to go too far off on a tangent, one of the things that amuses me is that most of the personal rituals in Catholicism are taken almost directly from Hindu practice.
Yeah.
So counting prayers with a rosary is the same as counting mantras with a mala, and lighting the candles, and sitting in the presence of a statue of a deity and asking for their intervention. All are identical. The use of incense are almost exactly identical, not in philosophy and understanding, but in what's actually being done. So there was somewhere along the line, all of that came from India into the Roman Empire and was integrated into the whole Catholic experience. Didn't move to Protestantism, but it certainly is in there with Catholicism.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. And I like what you said. Yeah, the rituals and everything if you look historically, have been borrowed from India, you know, specifically Hinduism. And there's a lot of, you know, especially in India, because Indians have a tendency to think that their tradition is always the best. But there is stories of a white man, a saint, way back, called Saint Isha, and Saint Isha is believed to actually be Christ, to be Jesus Christ.
Right.
And it's believed that in their eyes, that back way back then, that he came from the Middle East into India to learn the ways of the great sage Gautama the Buddha. You know, he came to learn the ways of the Buddha, the way of peace and the way of introspection. And then obviously along the way, he gathered a lot of, you know, Vedic rituals and so forth and so on, and brought it back, and that was integrated a lot into Christianity. What became Christianity? That's the belief,
right? Which is fascinating, also, because most of his practice that we know about was very Jewish. So
yeah, exactly,
how those Hindu practices wound up somehow going through Judaism and into Christianity? I've never seen anybody figure that one out. We're going to be going to a break in a couple of minutes, so I want to make sure people know where to find you online.
Okay, yeah. My website is jasongregory.org, so just my name. My Facebook, I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. My Twitter is jasongregory33, and my Facebook is jasongregory/oneworldwithin, and my YouTube is youtube.com/oneworldwithin, where I have actually episodes of I do regular episodes of a show called Enlightenment Today, so I talk about a lot of these traditions and that, so if anyone's interested.
Very cool. And I assume that the books are all on Amazon.
Yeah, they're all on Amazon. There's in bookshops and everywhere. Barnes & Noble, my publisher, Inner Traditions.
Right. So. And when we come back, we will talk about the whole concept you put together in Fasting the Mind, which I find totally fascinating. You know, it's kind of like the joke, if you unplug anything and leave it off for a while and plug it back in, it'll work again, including you. But you've gone a whole lot further than that.
Yeah.
So
I feel it's the time. We're in a time where we need to sort of do that too, David.
Right. Yeah. So we're coming up on the break. We will be back shortly, unless we get taller. My guest is Jason Gregory. His book is Fasting the Mind, and we will be back to talk about the book. This is David Franklin Farkas on the Farkas Files on Empower Radio. Don't go nowhere. We're going to have more fun.
Meditation Channel, non-stop meditation music 24 hours a day in the new Empower Radio app. Music to empower your meditation, help you relax, sleep, or provide a calm background while you work. The Empower Meditation Channel is interruption free. Listen now with the Empower Radio app, free in the App Store, or listen online at empower.fm. Soothe your soul, calm your mind. The Empower Meditation Channel.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in physics, I learned that I'm a loser.
Today in school, in math, I learned that I'm ugly and useless. And, trash. And in gym, in biology, I learned that I'm pathetic that I'm fat and a joke. And stupid. In history, I learned that I'm trash.
Today in school, I learned that I have no friends. In biology, in English, I learned that I make people sick. And at lunch, I learned that I sit on my own because I smell. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes
me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid.
In English,
and in math, I learned that I'm trash.
The only thing I didn't learn in school today.
The only thing I didn't learn today.
The only thing I didn't learn
is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov, a message from the Ad Council.
This is a guided meditation on parenting. Begin by finding a comfortable, relaxed position. Let out whatever stress is in your body. It could be from the time you left your daughter's blouse in the dryer too long and it shrunk four sizes, or when you donated her private diary to the public library. Or when you thought chaperoning the school dance meant actually dancing in the school dance. Whatever it is, let it go. The fire you started with that experimental dinner, let it go. The time you drove away from the gas pump with the gas pump, let it go. Three, very relaxed. Two, there you go. One.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
I'm John, a volunteer at United Way. I'm here at Lincoln Elementary School to find out what this place needs. Who knows better about what kids need than kids, right? Let's ask them.
Monsters!
Lasers!
A pool!
Another guinea pig!
More lasers!
Sprinkles!
I was thinking more spinach at lunchtime and maybe more exercise.
Nah.
Lasers are cool.
When it comes to creating healthier communities, what this place needs is you. To donate or volunteer, go to unitedway.org. Because great things happen when we live united. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Radio to inspire, encourage, and empower you. This is Empower Radio.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with my guest, Jason Gregory, the author of Fastening the Mind. And let's talk a little bit about what you talk about in the book.
Okay, for sure. Well, Fastening the Mind itself is a pretty old practice, an ancient practice, actually, going back into the Vedic civilization. But the practice has never been, I guess, it only been sort of named like this in the Zhuangzi text. Zhuangzi is an ancient Taoist philosopher. And when the text was translated from Chinese over into English, he specifically says to his disciple, you must fast the mind. Now, the whole idea of that is fasting the mind is very similar to, similar in scope to fasting the body, where if you, for example, if you fast the body, you're allowing the body to heal, to get rid of toxins, and so forth and so on. And the idea in especially the East is if we do that also to the mind, then it has the same effect, but on a subconscious level. So, a lot of our problems and our own personal suffering and all come from a lot of this, the subconscious content that we have wound up within us that, you know, it's beneath consciousness. So it's hard to deal with, hard to interact with, you know, so they came up with certain practices like this just to, you know, to tackle that and also to keep a mind, an equanimous mind, you know, which a lot of us want. We want a state of equanimity within our mind, but it's difficult, especially within the busy world. So the idea is basically in our world, you know, especially with how busy it is, we're taking in so much sensory input all the time. So, you know, whether we know it or not, our subconscious is being affected by certain things around us. You know, for example, if you perpetually watch TV all the time, or you're always scrolling the Facebook feeds and this and that, this is having an effect on a subconscious level, even though you think it's not, which causes a lot of latent anxieties and other sufferings that we don't really know about or engage with. So fasting the mind is basically about trying to stay away from all sensory input, or cultivating that in your life where you're not so engaged with a lot of sensory input, but also it encounters the idea of also mental renunciation. So the training, which is a, you know, a specific training, obviously, in Vedanta, Buddhism, and Taoism, of developing the ability to see your mind objectively and see how it's, you know, agitated, the thoughts are going crazy all the time, and developing this skill of mental renunciation. And this began in the Vedic civilization with the practice of, well, in Sanskrit, they have neti neti, which means actually neither this nor that, or not this, not this. And a lot of people, a lot of especially modern Vedanta or Advaita Vedanta teachers think that this means not the body. But when you look at the Upanishads, or you listen to teachers like Sri Ramana Maharishi, it's more so about mental renunciation, about stepping outside of the, or not engaging with that anxiousness that we have, or that personality we have that's always constantly thinking about the world and itself, and which we would call the ego. So basically developing that ability to see that objectively, and what that does is the more you renounce that, I don't mean renounce and completely get rid of it, that's impossible, but the more that you can train yourself to see it and not engage with it, you know, its emotional aspects and so forth and so on, it has a deep psychological, and it even affects your nervous system.
Sure. And that's shown with trauma victims, especially children. It completely changes the brain if a child is raised with constant abuse. So it in that case, it's literally changing the way the brain develops in young kids.
Yeah, it definitely is. It has such a big effect. You know, a lot of people, you know, I think a lot of the diseases, and, you know, the East would say that this is for sure, that a lot of the diseases that we have come from a mind that's just too busy. You know, our mind is not, I forget who said this, it was a psychologist. They said that our mind is not digital, it's analog. So,
right.
So, you know, it doesn't operate the way that technology operates, but we're trying to make it operate that way, and we're losing a lot of our nature. Our nervous system and our brain is not built that way. You know, it doesn't function that way. So when we're trying to multitask and we're doing too many things, you know, someone might be looking at the internet and they're on the phone at the same time. You know, these sort of things are depleting your nervous system. You know, we are a creature that should be doing one thing at a time. And, you know, the irony is that most people, especially in business, who are successful entrepreneurs or something like that, they develop the skill of mastering one thing at a time, because they know multitasking. When you multitask, you just get lost. You know, there's so many things to do, and you don't actually achieve anything. But what this does to, you know, there's two parts. What I talk about in fasting the mind, one aspect of it is the ancient Eastern science of the nervous system. So you have in the nervous system, in the autonomic nervous system, you have two strands. You have the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. So The sympathetic nervous system is more to do with activity, you know, doing. So even when you're watching something, if you're watching something on the computer or on television, you're still actively engaged because your senses are taking in sensory input, which is having an effect on your mind. And so what this does is people, for example, will wake up in the morning and they will just be doing all day. They'll wake up, they might check their emails, they'll go to work, they'll be in conversations all day. It's very busy. Then they come home and they watch TV or they engage on social media and they're completely anxious and stressful. And you can tell this by people's erratic emotions, that they're just too busy. And so what this is actually doing in the nervous system is you're just destroying yourself because you're only accessing the sympathetic nervous system. And the way that the sympathetic nervous system is actually nourished is when we access the parasympathetic nervous system, but that can only be accessed through relaxation, through deep relaxation, and having no activity at all. So right. a lot of people will say, "Yeah, but I go to sleep. Sleep is okay, but the parasympathetic nervous system actually needs to be nourished in our waking hours." So, you know, I speak a lot about that in the book. You know, obviously stillness meditation is a good way of activating the parasympathetic nervous system. And a lot of people will say, "Yeah, but I can't meditate properly. I got to sit and my thoughts are going everywhere and I'm still agitated." But the whole idea is that you've sat down and you've just said, "I'm not going to do anything. You know, this 20 to 30 minutes, I'm just going to sit here and watch my mind or watch my breath or whatever practice that you do." But that instantly activates the parasympathetic nervous system, which actually nourishes the sympathetic nervous system. So, you know, I talk about in the book about methods and that techniques to try and to implement into your life where you can access that more, which will actually ironically enhance your intellectual life and your professional life, whatever that may be. So, but you know, the problem is because we ignore the parasympathetic nervous system. Our nervous system is just so agitated because we're only accessing the sympathetic nervous system that we're leading to all sorts of, I would say also modern diseases like, you know, depression and a lot of these psychological problems that people have is because the world's just got so busy, but not implementing certain things. You know, people don't even go for a walk in nature anymore, David. So,
right.
You know, all of these things to access the parasympathetic nervous system is actually very easy. You just have to go for a walk in nature or sit with a dog and be in the presence of a dog, you know, all of these simple things, which we're actually too busy for now. So,
the Japanese actually call taking a walk in nature forest bathing.
Yeah, well, it's true, isn't it? It's
true.
You know, when I lecture around the world and I speak about these certain topics, I ask people, and I always know the answer. I always say, "What's the most memorable experience that you've had, you know, by yourself or with your friends and your family?" And they always say, "Time spent in nature." You know, like, "Oh, I went to the Grand Canyon," or "I went to, you know, Niagara Falls," or "I went into a forest." And the reason is because, you know, that deep peace that we find from it, that forest bathing, as the Japanese say. So,
right.
You know,
for a lot of people, it's the beach.
It's the beach. Yeah. You know, I've never heard anyone say to me, "Oh, it's going to time. I just go into Times Square." And, you know, I've never quite heard that before, but,
well, there are certainly some young people who are still in a place where they think that. But one of the interesting things about all of those is all of those natural phenomena are negative ion generators. The movement of the water, the crystalline nature of the sand, large rocks, certainly something like Niagara Falls is just throwing off huge amounts of negative ions, and negative ions make you feel better.
Exactly. And yeah, it's just that, and again, I think with that, with what you said, and also a lot of people also don't, from feeling those certain things, they don't have a sense of connection with the world as well. So they might be in New York City and they're actively engaged with the busy life that New York City is, and you lose sense of you will, not only do you lose sense of yourself, but you lose sense of that you're part of something much greater than just a than just your body and your own mind. You know, you're part of something much larger. But you could feel that a lot more when you're in nature. And I actually speak about this in the book a lot, not specifically with nature, but also with in relation to cognitive science, where cognitive science had done a lot of research for a long time on mindfulness and on a lot of things. And they came up with a good model, which I discuss in the book. It's the dual processing model, where you have two different, all of us have two different functions in the mind, where we have, it was originally called system one and system two, but I use the more modern terms of hot cognition and cold cognition. Basically, cold cognition is located within the prefrontal cortex of our brain. And that's the part, that's the conscious controller. That's the David that you think of, David, or I think of Jason, the I that we all think of ourselves, that tries to control everything and manage everything. I mean, it has a purpose and it has a use. It's not to say that it's completely, you know, in the book, I don't say that, that's a fault in any way, but it's what we do, the way we're trained in the world is we overemphasize for this cold cognition. You know, our education trains you to be very analytical and so forth and so on. And we neglect the more ancient cognition within us, which is the hot cognition, which is found in the more unconscious parts of the brain, which actually is what makes your hands open and close. It's the fast, spontaneous cognition within us. You know, it's what makes us respond spontaneously to certain things. It can have intuitive areas. It can be overly emotional, but it's what brings the beauty to life. You know, so if you look at, for example, I use sports as an example in my book. If you look at a remarkable athlete who has trained a lot, they just have this naturalness about the way that they do things. They can just do things spontaneously without having to think about it.
Right.
And that's the hot cognition in play. The irony is that you need to learn certain things in sport. So you need to use your cold cognition to learn certain movements and that, but you train your body a certain way to act spontaneously.
Right.
And in the East, they talk about the trained spontaneity, but there's also the natural spontaneity. So it's what we already have endowed within us, you know. So, you know, this was a big debate within the Warring States period of China, where between Lao Tzu and Confucius and Zhuangzi and so forth and so on. But anyway, the idea was universally amongst them, you know, they didn't use cognitive sciences, they didn't have the terminology, but we do. So we can say is that what they understood was, is that a lot of the problems happen when we're always in cold cognition, we're always the self, we're always the I, the person. So that gets in the way of a lot of just the natural beauty and spontaneity of life. You know, in some of my lectures last year when I spoke in America, I mentioned the story of Wang Yu. Wang Yu was a young girl in China back in 2011 who got run over by she left her mother in the marketplace, and then she was strolling around, and she was very young. I think she was 2 years old, and she was just, I don't know how she got away from her mother. Anyway, a van ran over her. The van stopped, and the van was kind of on Wang Yu, and then the van just took away, just drove away, and she's on the ground, and I don't know if she was alive at that moment or not. But anyway, a second car came and accidentally ran over her, and then took off as well. And then this is all on CCTV footage. And then the amazing thing is that 18 bystanders just walk past her, and they look, they see her, but then they go away. They just go on their way. There was only one old grandmother who came out screaming and you know, found her and whatnot. And unfortunately she died, Wang Yu. And what this says is, from what I'm trying to explain, is that we're trained in this world now to be mainly analytical people. So a lot of research was done in cognitive science on that specific event. And a lot of those people who just walked past couldn't get out of their own mind that they have certain things to do on the day. You know, they had to get a good job, and it conflicts with their daily routine, what they had trying to control and they set out. Obviously, their naturalness within them is, oh geez, there's a young girl in agony or almost dying. I should help. But the problem is that overrode that naturalness. And this is why in the East, they specifically, targeted that, because it does lead to problems like that, you know. And the research that was done on that incident in China, the remarkable thing about it is when they did a poll in China, most of the people said they would do the same thing, and they said that because of cold indifference. So they just have cold indifference to the world, and this comes from being only in the cold cognition, because you're not connected with anything else. You are a person. You're separate from the world, and everything else. So the irony is when you attempt to fast the mind, you're attempting to fast that cold cognition. So in cognitive science, what they've realized is that when you practice mindfulness or you practice just stillness meditation, is that you actually are down regulating. You're decreasing the impact of the cold cognition, and you're allowing the hot cognition to come to life. And the hot cognition, when you start to align more with that, you feel this greater sense of unity, this deep peace within yourself, and you have more of this spontaneous, this spontaneity about you, you know. So that's one of the things in cognitive science, and also what was the focus in the East. But on the other hand, you can also downregulate the cold cognition with certain things like alcohol and that, but they're not sufficient tools of it, obviously, you know.
Right, and that's the quick and dirty, cheap solution that most people look for.
It is.
Self-medicating in some way or distraction.
It is. And, you know, you and I, David, we could go to the bar or something like that, and we could have a lot of drinks, and we could be there, I love you, man, I love you. We can be doing all these things because the cold cognition is downregulated, but it's terrible for our health. It's self-medicating, like what you said, all of these things. Where on the other hand, we can practice meditation or mindfulness in the day. We can implement certain things in our life that keep away a lot of sensory overload, and we can become more conscious of ourselves. And then we can have more of that naturalness, that natural spontaneity in the whole cognition, just about our character, without having to be too rigid as we usually are as a person. So, you know, yeah, that's one of the key points also in fasting the mind is understanding this framework of hot and cold cognition, and how if we come back in alignment with hot cognition, then we can bring a lot of the spontaneous beauty of the world that's deep within us to the world. We can inspire others. We can, you know, not be so controlling, because in the end, how much can we control in this world? Is
right.
We can control certain things, but not much. And to just put a little bit on that point, what I'm saying is Zhuangzi, the ancient Taoist sage where we find the actual term mind fasting first, is he actually said that this cold cognition was an actual flaw in us. So he calls it Qing in Chinese, where Qing is a species-specific essence where, you know, a horse gallops very gracefully. That's its essence. And he said that our species-specific essence is this controlling eye that we have within us that gets in the way of nature and beauty and connection with the world and others. And that's why he sort of said, you know, you have to fast the mind. You have to get rid of this Qing, which actually is, you know, in Vedanta, they say Maya. It's the same as Maya. It's right. The illusion of reality, where you are measuring everything according to your personality. You know, David's David. That's right. That's wrong. This is good. That is bad. That's what Qing is. And so Zhuangzi said that needs to be fasted away. We need to get rid of Qing to have this greater sense of beauty, and to understand that in some sense there is not really a right and wrong in the world. There's just sort of a happening and a what is, and we're a part of something much greater than that.
I'm always fascinated that, you know, with the Chinese culture goes back 5,000 years, the stuff in in India goes back 3, 4, 5,000 years, and the issues are the same. we think we're so cool and we're above it all and we're modern and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And you read this incredibly ancient insight and they're talking about the same problems that we have now. you know, in Western culture, we read the things that the Romans said, and think that that was a long time ago, but you know, China, China is 5 or 6,000 years and they're talking about the same issues. So
it's true. Yeah, it's true. It's, you know, I guess in the West and the modern world in general, we kind of focus a lot of our problems just on, you know, convenience and comfortability, when mm-hmm. the real psychological problems and social problems are still the same as they were back in the Vedic civilization and right. the warring states period of China, you know. So, and we're still, in the same position we've always been in, you know, and that's part of the inspiration behind my book, is to try and, you know, bring a lot of this to light so we can actually start to work on ourselves to build a better society and to appreciate other cultures and other religions and other races and so forth and so on, to, you know, to live in a better world. So
which is a perfect place for us to tie this together, because as is always the case with people that are so fascinating, we're out of time. Obviously, we could keep talking for another hour, but we're out of time. Would give people the information about how to find you online.
Okay, yeah, you can find, well, my website is jasongregory.org. My Twitter is @jasongregory33. My Facebook is jasongregory/oneworldwithin. And my YouTube, if you're interested in my videos that I put up regularly, it's youtube.com/oneworldwithin.
Fantastic. And the book is?
Fasting the Mind.
Fasting the Mind, and you can find that everywhere, all the usual places that you can find books. So check it out. It's a wonderful book. I didn't get to read all of it, but I was fascinated with the stuff that I got to read. So, Jason, thank you so much for the work that you do and the insights that you bring to all of us.
Likewise, David. Thank you for, you know, doing everything that you do and allowing people like myself to come on and discuss this.
I get to have fun and I meet some fascinating people. It's a wonderful thing. So, and I get to, I have a dear friend in Brizzy that I don't talk to very often. So every time I talk to an Australian, I feel like, oh, I like this. there's something for me about the Australian accent that's very sweet. So thank you for that too. Not that you did it on purpose.
Thank you, David.
So my guest tonight has been Jason Gregory. His latest book is Fasting the Mind. Go check it out. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you, David.
And if you got curious about who is this guy David and what in the world does he do, you can go to househealing.com. There's all kinds of technologies for getting in touch with me, including a link to schedule a 20-minute free phone consultation to assess what's going on with the person, place, situation, business, whatever it happens to be, and we can see whether my work might be helpful to you. If you want to know more about the show, go to, cleverly enough, thefarkasfiles.com, and the whole archive is there. We've been doing this for six-plus years, so there's hundreds and hundreds of wonderful conversations with fascinating people. But the easiest way to listen to the show now is to get the Empower Radio app for both flavors of smartphones. That lets you just open up any of the many shows that are on Empower Radio. It's 24/7 programming with wonderful information and wonderful people. You just click on the show. It opens up all the shows in the archive, and you can click on any one of them and listen at your convenience, which is amazing and something that's only been developed in the last few years. How great is that? So We're also on all the streaming media, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, iTunes podcasts, all of those places. Just plug in Empower Radio or Farkas Files, and you can access things that way. And thank you for doing that. Wherever you are, whenever you are listening to this, we appreciate it, because otherwise, why would I be doing this? It's all about the conversation with you. And so until next week, thank you one and all for being with us. This is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Have a fantastic week. We'll be right back.